In his book, The Youth Builder, Jim Burns talks about the importance of building up young people with affirmation and trust. What he says about criticism applies to every age group. He says, for every critical comment we receive, it takes 9 affirming comments to even out the negative effect in our life. Most young people receive more critical comments in a day than encouraging ones. You can have a very positive, life-transforming effect when you develop a ministry of affirmation. One doesn't have to be very old to have experienced the bite and sting of harsh criticism or unkind negative comments. With our tongues, we can cause such pain and scarring in others' lives by thoughtless or intentionally cutting words. We can relate to that ratio of it taking 9 affirming comments to counter 1 negative one. In today's text, we meet a champion God raised up to shepherd his people Israel. A champion who, with the Lord's help, overcame verbal abuse and physical threat by trusting in God to be his deliverer. First, let's set the stage a bit so we can appreciate more the impact David had. By this point in Saul's reign, about 1030 BC, Israel was at a severe disadvantage, humanly speaking, compared to the surrounding nations. Monarchy was still very young as a new invention. Saul was the new king on the block. Other countries were better organized politically and militarily. Other armies were more experienced and better equipped. The historian notes in chapter 13 that the only soldiers with actual swords were King Saul and his son Jonathan. Think about that. The whole Israelite army, and how many swords do they have? 2. Sharp, pointy things, slings, that's what they had to rely on. The Philistines completely controlled the iron industry. There wasn't a blacksmith in the whole land of Israel. Farmers had to go to the Philistines, that is, the enemy, to get their plows and sickles sharpened. So they were behind significantly when it came to technology. Chapter 17 opens with the Philistines assembling to make war against Israel. Saul and the Israelites camped across this steep valley opposite them. Now, whoever initiated the battle would find themselves at a disadvantage from the get-go because they'd have to go down to the bottom of the valley, then up the steep side, uphill against their opponent. And we already noted the Israelites' severe weapons limitation. For 40 days, there is a stalemate as the giant Goliath challenged the Israelites to produce a contender for a match to decide the army's fate. The man God had been preparing for the task was not actually in the Israelite army just then. He was back home at Bethlehem, guarding some sheep. God had been getting a very special man ready for this task. Not this fight only, but for becoming Israel's most famous king of all time. Servant of Saul sums up David's qualities in 16:18. He says, I have seen a son of Jesse of Bethlehem who knows how to play the harp. He's a brave man and a warrior. He speaks well and is a fine-looking man. And the Lord is with him. Quite a list of commendation. A warrior poet. A fighter, but also an artist at the same time. David's musical ability is obvious in the book of Psalms, many of which he wrote. He wasn't just singing to the sheep. He was brave. A scrapper, full of fighting spirit. Bring him on. And he was also a statesman, knowing what to say, prudent in speaking well. I know maybe being the youngest of 8 boys had something to do with that, kind of learning diplomacy around the dining room table. But there was something else more important than any of these skills or gifts. God had been shaping David's heart, his inner person, his desires and will, to be in unison with God's. Both 1 Samuel 13 in the Old Testament and Acts 13 in the New describe David as a man after God's own heart. What about you? Are the Lord's priorities your priorities? Are you seeking first His kingdom and righteousness? Do you view your body members as tools to carry out His will? Are you listening each day for the Father's instruction so you can keep in step with the Spirit? That's kind of what being after God's heart is about. So David is a model for those who claim to be Christians, to have Jesus living inside us. You pick out from David's analysis of the stalemate what's most important to him, which is also what's most important to God, namely God's honor and glory. 17:46, answering Goliath's challenge, he says, "This day the Lord will hand you over to me, and I'll strike you down and cut off your head. Today I'll give the carcasses of the Philistine army to the birds of the air and the beasts of the earth." Here it comes. "And the whole world will know that there is a God in Israel." David was jealous for God's honor. He wanted everyone to know Yahweh is the one true God. That's high priority to God, too. In Exodus 9, God told Pharaoh, "But I've raised you up for this very purpose, that I might show you my power and that my name might be proclaimed in all the earth." Joshua told the Israelites after they crossed the Jordan River, "He did this so that all the peoples of the earth might know that the hand of the Lord is powerful, and so that you might always fear the Lord your God." God's keen to get the word out about how great and wonderful He is. Jesus' Great Commission echoes that. Make disciples of all nations. And we can't assume that even just because in a country like Ireland is relatively civilized and Western like us, that they don't need the gospel. That's why Hannah's going this week. Think of big cities even here like Detroit, or sorry to say Toronto as well. If you get right downtown, there's a jungle out there. And so please be praying for safety for Hannah and the team, and that God's truth will really impact the kids there. When David came upon the scene of the two armies in a stalemate, he had the prophetic sense that this wasn't just about two groups of differing ethnic, technological, and political background colliding. He identified the real issue was God's honor. That's what's at stake. He framed his response to the enemy's challenge in such a way as to reflect that. He said, "Who is this uncircumcised Philistine? He should defy the armies of the living God." The Lord had crafted David's character and creed in such a way that he was God's man for the moment, one ready to frame the situation in God's terms, to see what's really going on in a spiritual sense. If you'd been on the battlefield that day, you would have agreed the obstacles facing the Israelites were great. Few iron weapons, as we noted. The size of Goliath, 6 cubits and a span, about 9.5 feet tall. Huge, but not unheard of. Pliny records a man named Gabara from Arabia, 9 feet 9 inches. Josephus mentions a Jew named Eleazar at 10 feet 2 inches. And a Dr. Plott in his History of Staffordshire describes an Englishman, John Middleton by name, 9 feet 3 inches high during the reign of James I. Quote, "His hand from the carpus to the end of the middle finger was 17 inches. Okay, so we're talking, his would be about like that, I think, right? His hand. His palms, 8.5 inches broad. So his palm was about that wide. Now, can't you just picture somebody like that walking up to a certain fast food restaurant and saying, "Supersize me"? Sorry, I had to throw that in. No wonder Goliath went a long time with no takers for his challenge. Oh, and who would be the logical contestant among the Israelites? Remember who was tallest? Saul. And Saul was proclaimed king, we're told. As he stood among the people, he was a head taller than any of the others. Guess what, Saul? Your turn. Despite the pressure on the king, he realized he was no match physically. Why, Goliath's armor weighed as much as some people, 125 pounds of just armor on the guy. But those human obstacles melted away before the strength of God Almighty. What was David's secret? Not that he was stronger or taller or smarter or quicker than Goliath. David's secret of success was his relationship with God. For Samuel 18:14, "In everything he did, he had great success because the Lord was with him." As with Joseph back in Genesis 39, the Lord was with Joseph and gave him success in whatever he did. Remember, he was a slave in prison. And God picked him up from there and made him second in power in the whole country of Egypt. It's folly to trust merely in our own human resources. It's vain and deceitful to compare ourselves with others on a purely human basis. Michael Jackson, for example, had it all. Where is he now? Would any of us wish upon our offspring the legacy of legal disputes over property, debt, and custody that he's left behind? David is intentional about making the point that it's not his weaponry or skill that makes the difference in the outcome of the battle, but his sovereign God. He declines to use Saul's heavy armor. In verse 47, David warns Goliath, "All those gathered here will know that it's not by sword or spear that the Lord saves, for the battle is the Lord's, and He will give all of you into our hands." It's all about God's resources and relying on Him, not our own devices. Well, chances are you and I are not likely to find ourselves grappling with 3-meter-tall giants in hand-to-hand combat on a battlefield. Kind of happy to say I think that day has passed. But we are likely to encounter negative talk, ridicule, maybe an evil-for-good relationship. We've all slipped up in governing our tongues and spoken careless and unkind words. But for Christians, there's extra reason those who don't believe in Jesus may speak negatively to us. Jesus warned we'd be hated by others on His account. Those who are of the world will find a true Christian spiritually offensive. Note who David is attacked by verbally in this story. Yes, Goliath despises David and curses him by his gods. That's understandable. He's an enemy. But there are a couple of others. Look closely at Saul's discouraging words in verse 33. "You are not able to go out against this Philistine and fight him. You are only a boy, and he has been a fighting man from his youth." You hear that? "You're not able. You're only a kid." Some might say Saul's being a realist, but in retrospect, he's clearly defeatist. Without faith in God, he sees only David's limitations and inadequacy. But somebody even closer to David has the harshest words for him. Who's that? His eldest brother. Eliab, in verse 28, attacks his little bro on 5 fronts. It says, "Eliab burned with anger at him and asked, 'Why have you come down here? And with whom did you leave those few sheep in the desert? I know how conceited you are, how wicked your heart is. You came down only to watch the battle.'" Eliab attacks David's motive. "Why have you come? You came down only to watch the battle," as if to say, "You're no help, you're just slacking off." He attacks David's maturity. "With whom did you leave those few sheep in the desert?" As if David might have been so irresponsible as to wander off without finding somebody to look after them. He attacks whether David matters. "Those few sheep in the wilderness," as if to say, "Who do you think you are? You just look after a few lousy sheep out there in the sticks. You don't matter." He attacks David's modesty. "I know how conceited you are." As if all David can think about is himself, doing what he wants without regard to others, proud and full of conceit. And Eliab attacks David's morality. "I know how wicked your heart is." David hasn't done a thing wrong. He's barely arrived. All he did was bring provisions from home for his brothers, a care package. Yet what thanks does he get but a verbal whiplashing from his oldest sibling? Isn't that the way in our families sometimes? We can be the cruelest with those that we know best. It goes on, and we need to watch our tongues in that regard. And also seek God's healing. Some of those hurts go a long way back into our childhood, and we need to pray about that and ask God's help. Maybe David's toughest battle wasn't out facing a 9.5-foot giant that day. Maybe that was a picnic compared to his treatment around home. Maybe what could have wounded him the most was the angry words of someone in his own family. Certainly the Lord must have used his brother's treatment and abuse of him to develop David's character, just as God vindicated Joseph eventually after his brothers were so jealous of him back in Genesis. How did David respond when the words were flying? Did he return evil for evil? No, he simply asked in protest, "Now what have I done? Can't I even speak?" He didn't defend himself, but left it with God to be his defender. Likewise with Saul and Goliath, David responded by resting in God's faithfulness and love shown to him in the past. Verses 36 and 37, he said, "Your servant has killed both the lion and the bear. The Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine." We learn David's approach as Paul advised the Colossians. "Let your conversation be always full of grace, seasoned with salt, so that you may know how you should respond to each person." Charles Spurgeon suffered a firestorm of criticism when beginning his ministry in London. A steady stream of articles trashed his sermons, and pamphlets appeared denouncing his methods, his motives, mannerisms, and messages. He was vilified in cartoons and caricatures. Several writers questioned whether he was even converted. At first, this storm of cynicism and censure deeply hurt Spurgeon, who described himself as broken in agony. But his wife prepared a plaque of Matthew 5:11 for the wall of their home where Charles would see it first thing every day. Matthew 5:11 says, "Blessed are you when they revile you and persecute you and say all kinds of evil against you falsely for my sake. Rejoice and be exceedingly glad, for great is your reward in heaven." Well, the verse did its work, and in time Spurgeon learned to take criticism in stride. Not long before his death, years later, a friend visiting him in a study said, "You know, Mr. Spurgeon, some people think you conceited." The great preacher paused a moment, then he smiled and said with a twinkle in his eye, "Do you see those bookshelves? They contain hundreds, nay, thousands of my sermons that have been translated into every language under heaven. Well, now, add to this the fact that ever since I was 20 years old, there never has been built a place large enough to hold the numbers of people who wish to hear me preach, and upon my honor, when I think of it, I wonder I'm not more conceited than I am." Let's pray.